New evidence shows the Vatican manipulated the results of a bishop's survey in order to restrict the traditional Latin Mass. Independent Vatican journalist Diane Montagna is here with an update. And synodality is moving right along under Pope Leo XIV. The papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, are here with analysis. Less than a month after a massacre of Christians in Nigeria, more have been killed in the region. What is driving the violence? Director of the Center for Religious Freedom, Nina Shea, and Steve Wagner will join us. And Choir Master Charles Cole of the London Oratory Scola joins me to talk about his new CD, Sacred Treasures of Rome, the world over. Begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Last week, there were reports of a leaked document that was connected to the reasons why Pope Francis severely limited the traditional Latin Mass. This week, new evidence has come to light that seems to confirm that the Vatican manipulated the results of a survey taken of the world's bishops that, in the Pope's words, Pope Francis's words, compelled him to restrict the ancient form of the Mass. Joining me with an update of her bombshell report is independent Vatican journalist Diane Montagna. Diane, your blockbuster exclusive last week revealed that, in fact, the bishops of the world did not have a problem with wide celebration of the Latin Mass in their dioceses. Yet, in both Traditionis Custodes and the accompanying letter banning, all but banning, the traditional Mass, Pope Francis emphatically states that the survey results carried out by the CDF, the Doctrine Office of the Vatican, and summarized in their report were central to his decision to crack down on the ancient liturgy. He wrote this: "The responses reveal a situation that preoccupies and saddens me and persuades me of the need to intervene." Diane, given what we were told when that document was released and what you found last week, what does this mean for the credibility of the Vatican and its doctrinal office in this matter? And don't they owe the Universal Church an explanation?
Well, I think that's certainly true, Raymond. You know, this what was at the heart of this document, and the your viewers will understand that this document was put together as the official report by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's fourth section. Now, this part of the CDF what had been responsible for years for overseeing, and even under Pope Francis, overseeing the implementation of Summorum Pontificum. So they were the department, if you were, the entity within the Vatican most expert in these matters. Really at the heart of the report that they developed over those months was what was called an overall assessment. And at the heart of it was that the majority of bishops, contrary to what seemed to be communicated to us in Traditionis Custodes and the accompanying letter, that the majority of bishops thought that it would do more harm than good to make any legislative changes to Summorum Pontificum.
But Diane, why distort the truth in order to justify the Pope's restriction when the Pope could do whatever he liked? He didn't need a survey or the bishop's approval to do this.
Yeah, well, that's the mystery of this, Raymond, because the Pope could have come out and just said, I have decided, given my own findings and my own conversations, that it's time to revoke Summorum Pontificum. I think what may have happened, Raymond, is that back in 2020, there was, and I've reported on this, there was a meeting within the CDF at which Cardinal Daria, the prefect, was absent because he was sick that day. And it was then at that meeting, I've reported on this, that several of the cardinals started to be very open about their problems with the traditional Latin Mass. That was in January 2020. Your viewers will keep in mind that the survey went out to the bishops in spring of 2020. And then in the subsequent months, this was developed. So my guess is that two things. One, the Pope may have been pressured by some of the bishops, by cardinals, to take a step to restrict the traditional Latin Mass. It could have also been that the Pope expected the results of the survey to show something that they didn't. It may have been a surprise to him, and have already been, you know, may have been a desire to restrict the traditional Latin Mass. We don't want to speak ill of Pope Francis. It is well known, even in his autobiography, Hope, that he had some negative attitudes towards the traditional Latin Mass and towards those who are attached to it, calling them backwardists.
This week you updated your report and you say the Vatican Doctrinal Office 2020 summary of this bishop's survey on the old Mass was in fact authentic. You've uncovered a protocol number for that final report. Now tell us first, why is that important?
The protocol number helps because every official document within the Vatican that's developed receives an official Vatican protocol number. So I put a photograph of that, of the cover of the report out. It shows that this was the report issued in February 2020 based on the consultation of bishops, and it has the protocol number. So there can be no doubt, really, that the document is authentic.
At the July 3rd Vatican press conference, which was intended to unveil a new Mass for the care of creation, Holy See spokesman Matteo Bruni was asked about the authenticity of the text that you released, okay, that seemed to suggest that Pope Francis and the Vatican lied about the results of this survey of bishops. Bruni said the following, "I am not confirming the genuineness of the texts that have been published. This is part of one of the documents on which the decision was based. And this, of course, is very incomplete and a partial reconstruction. Now, the consultation that has just been mentioned was then supported by other documentation and other reports and further consultations that the Dicastery of the Doctrine of Faith has received. But I won't add anything else because this has nothing to do with today's press conference." Now, Diane, I love the part about I'm not confirming, but this is one of the documents that inform the decision, which sounds like a confirmation. What does the new evidence you obtained this week say about Bruni's July 3rd comments, and what do you make of those?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, Matteo Bruni, and your viewers should keep in mind that this was a press conference that pertained to the Dicastery for Divine Worship. That's why the question was asked, because you had an official from the Dicastery who's now charged with enforcing Traditus Custodes there on the panel. But what's interesting is that right before, it was Hannah Brockhaus from CNA who asked the question, and right before she asked the question, Matteo Bruni, the Vatican spokesman, welcomes to the press office Cardinal Victor Fernandez, the prefect for the congregation, now Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. So he was also there. So it's clear that this was organized damage control, because they knew that given that there was a press conference, somebody was likely to ask a question. And I want to make it clear, I like Matteo Bruni very much. He's doing his job. This was a prepared statement on a sheet of paper that he read out. But Matteo Bruni said that in addition to the consultation that was done in 2020 by the CDF, that there were other documents. And in fact, he said other confidential reports based on further consultations that were submitted to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So wait a second. We didn't hear about that from Pope Francis. We're only now hearing about that from the Vatican press office. Pope Francis only told us, and he was firm about it, that he ordered the consultation, the detailed consultation from the CDF in 2020, and that the results so saddened him and concerned him that he felt he had to do something. So yes, the Vatican is now saying 4 years later that there were further documents that went into this, but that's not what Pope Francis told us. Furthermore, in order for those, and this is what I put out today, in order for those further documents and those further confidential reports based on further consultations to have any weight whatsoever, they would have had to overridden the CDF document. So basically, these further documents would have had to prove that the official CDF document had inaccurately concluded that the majority of bishops wanted to stay the course with Summorum Pontificum.
Diane, given all of this evidence that is now coming to light, do you think Pope Leo is going to be compelled to act? And what are you hearing from bishops in Rome? What's the reaction to this?
Yeah, well, the story has been quite big. I mean, Nicole Winfield did an excellent article for the Associated Press. So this story has gone all over the world. And I think it's of particular interest, certainly to Catholics, but to non-Catholics, in part because the FBI was investigating traditional Latin Mass Catholics. So it has wide resonance throughout the world. Regarding Pope Leo, I do want to make something clear. You know, I put this out, if you want to call it a divine leak. You know, how did I get this? This has been on my mind for a long time. I prayed to the Lord to send it to me. So maybe, you know, the Lord wanted this out because he allowed for me to have it. And I did it for the good of the church. And I did it for the truth. I think it's good for the family of the church to know the truth about this. And I certainly don't have any intention whatsoever to try in any way to force Pope Leo to do anything or to compel Pope Leo to do anything. And no one should. Pope Leo is a good man. He has a deep relationship with the Lord. He's a reasonable man. And he is a man who does not want injustice. So I simply think that there's hope that we could see him do something perhaps in the autumn.
Well, we'll keep watching that, and we'll keep watching your reporting. You can follow Diane Montagna on X and dianemontagna.substack.com. Thank you, Diane. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Raymond.
With reaction to the Latin Mass liturgy controversy and the ongoing push for synodality under Pope Leo, I'm joined by the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gents, I want to get your reaction to those new developments Diane Montagna brought to us. Father, then Bob, your thoughts on Matteo Bruni's insistence that the leaked document was only one of many pieces of information. As you heard from Diane there, then maybe we need to see more of this.
I agree, Raymond. Yes, this press conference response was obviously damage control. It was an attempt to kind of like say, well, what was revealed, not sure if it's true, but if it is, but then on the other hand, it's only partial. No, it was an accurate report of what the bishops told the Holy See. Now, if the Holy See got other information from bishops that contradicts that, then we need to know that, because otherwise we're left with the problem, because Pope Francis said he got the report from the CDF regarding what the bishop said, and it troubled him and saddened him because it revealed great damage being done to the church by the traditional Latin Mass permissions, and that's why he was going to restrict them. So, yeah, this damage control will not solve this issue. If there are other documents that make their case, they need to be made public.
Yeah, Bob, Pope Benedict had brought a certain peace to the valley when he gave wide permission to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass. Summorum Pontificum had calmed the liturgy wars. You had the old rite, you had the new rite. I guess the question is, why did Pope Francis feel that manipulating the truth or lying about this survey was necessary, particularly when he had ultimate authority to do whatever he likes?
Yeah, look, it's puzzling, of course, and I think you that question that you also asked Diane is the key question here. I think the reason why he would want to do it is he had staked his entire papacy on this idea of synodality, and we know that synodality is a hard thing to define. But if it means anything, it means consulting with one another, listening to one another, respecting one another, you know, getting input from one another, and so. I think when he asked that survey to be done, he thought that what he was going to get back was what he wanted to do, which was to limit the availability of the traditional Latin Mass. That didn't happen. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, as Diane and others have reported, only about 20% of the bishops even bothered to respond. Most of them didn't. They weren't troubled enough, or they weren't moved enough even to reply to the Pope. But those 20%, as Diane said, pretty much made it clear that it would produce more harm than good to go on to something else. Now, Leo is really confronted here, and I'm glad Diane used the word justice, because that's the term I would use here, because lots of people have been harmed in their deepest ways of worshiping on Sundays, and they were harmed in a way that was based on untruth. So Leo's got an obligation here. I want to point out that this past week, he announced, along with further things about what's going on in the the synodal process, that there is going to be a further study group that is going to look at liturgy, and it's supposed to give a report, I think, to him in December. So I think Diane may not be right that we'll get something in the fall. But certainly he's put that on the agenda, perhaps to stimulate a real consultation about where we stand with these two different forms of the Western Rite. And if we get the right people debating that, maybe we'll get some resolution of this injustice.
Yeah, well, Father, there's the key question. If you get a balanced consultation, but will we get a balanced consultation given the way the synodality, you know, these synod structures have been formed in the past? They kind of got burned early because they brought a wide consultation in and found conflicting voices that said, we don't want to go down this synodal path.
Yes, and you'll recall, Raymond, that for the last Synod on Synodality number 2 last October, about 10 important topics were taken off the table because they were given to expert committees. And those expert committees, their reports were due this in June. Now they're going to be due in December to more expert committees, as Bob mentioned, being formed. This kind of is confounding. How can you say we're going to consult the people of God in a synodal setting and then basically turn it over to the in-house experts? And that's what we've gotten here. Who are they? And many of the committees, we do know who's on it. But for instance, the doctrinal committee that's going to consider female diaconate, whether that's acceptable, which it isn't, but that they're looking at it. Those committee members, we don't even know who they are. Who is going to pick the people on the liturgy committee? There's another one on canon law that's been formed. So we already have a structure of committees. It's called the Roman Curia. Their job is to do all these things that's being repeated by the synodal committees. I hope and pray that this thing gets whittled down because it's spiraling out of control into bureaucratic control of the church.
Yeah, well, this is a good segue to synodality remaining a constant in this new pontificate. Some thought it might be dialed down. It doesn't appear that way. The General Secretariat of the Synod issued a new document on the ongoing implementation of the Synod on Synodality this week. And in that document, Pope Leo announced the creation of, as Bob mentioned, yet another study group. This one, quote, on the liturgy in a synodal perspective. Not sure what that means. Also this week, it was announced that the deadline for those established synod groups would be extended to the end of the year. Father, what do you think this new study group on the liturgy from a synodal perspective means? And do you agree with Bob? Is this going to be kind of is it an opening to re-examine the liturgy? And if the Pope needed to do that, why does he need to have a study group to do that? He can do that on his own.
Well, it's mysterious, that you would have study groups to study matters that were not brought up earlier. The Pope has an interest in them, but why are they in? I guess it means that everything now forward has to be looked at in a synodal perspective, which is, again, a strange thing, because what is the synodal church? The church is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. Synodality is a minor aspect of how the church governs herself. But now it's become like, a fifth mark of the church. In that document that you referred to that the Synod Committee just issued, it talks about building a synodal church. That's a terrifying statement. We don't build any church. The church is given to us by God. And within the church, we use governing structures which reflect the nature of the church, which is it's an apostolic church. It's not based on getting all the sheep together and gathering their opinions. It's based on the shepherds conveying the message of Christ. So it's troubling that all of these things are continuing.
Bob, we are on this path to not only synodal implementation, but institutionalization of the synod. Sister Natalie Bequart, who's the undersecretary of the General Secretariat of the Synod, flat out said this week, synodality is really Vatican II in bloom, essentially. It's the realization of Vatican II because you just didn't get it. John Paul II and Benedict must have been asleep while, they were attending the council, because now we're seeing the real council come forward. It seems this revolution in church decision-making is continuing.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think that, regrettably, Sister Natalie is trying to shoehorn Vatican II, which is a controversial council in many ways, of course. We've been debating it for 60 years. But it is not one simple thing. There are some very good things that have come out of Vatican II, scripture studies and whatnot. There are some other things that are much iffier. And so to try to make it appear as if Vatican II is basically synodality, I don't see this as bearing any relation to reality whatever. And in terms of these study groups that we're talking about now, okay, I think we shouldn't forget that these are groups that will present results to the Holy Father, who can either accept them or he can reject them. You know, he can look at what the so-called experts who have been assigned to these different committees, these study groups, have come up with, but it's he's the one that has to make the decision. So, look, in some ways, as we know, I mean, I live in Washington, we know that committees are things that, or study groups are things that really put off having to make a decision. And the fact that these
right.
these deadlines keep getting set back farther and farther means somebody doesn't want to have to, you know, take the bit between his teeth and make a decision. And maybe that's what's happening with some of the other ones. But about liturgy in particular, which is the way that people worship, we have a group of people who've benefited from this traditional Latin Mass. And not everybody has, nobody makes you go to the traditional Latin Mass. You choose to go there. You benefit from it. As long as you respect others, Benedict always used to say, let us allow the largest diversity possible within the parameters of the Orthodox tradition. That's the diversity within unity that the Catholic Church seeks to practice.
Father, that thing you mentioned earlier keeps lingering in my mind. As Bob was talking, I kept thinking about it. What we're really, and just so everybody understands, I feel so bad for Pope Leo because it's like he's been dropped in the middle of this new structure that Pope Francis put into place, and it is an innovation. We have to say it. A synod of bishops is when bishops come together and give the Pope their opinion. This synodality is everybody, lay people and nuns and atheists, everybody and their dog coming in and having a say. What position do you think, A, he's put in because of this pre-existing synodal structure? And what does it mean now that they're saying, hey, it's coming to every parish and every diocese now? It reminds me of Little Shop of Horrors at the end when the little plants start showing up. When here we come for you, you know, it's everywhere. You can't get away from it.
Well, no, this is a profound shift, this synod on synodality. Well, number one, back to Vatican II. Vatican II created the Synod of Bishops, and then it was implemented afterwards by Paul VI, and it was a meeting that happened every 2 or 3 years. And then it's, you know, the meeting was over, and then they brought up a new topic the next time. Now this is going on. It's become a process, and they talk about it in such ways. And now we're getting detailed instructions for further meetings, and they're going to have assemblies and dioceses, nations and continental. But, you know, the interesting thing is apparently the Synod's not good enough because they've canceled the one for 2028, and they're replacing it with something called the Ecclesial Assembly. So they announced a new structure at the universal level of the church, but they didn't tell us what it is, who's going to be part of it. You know, the unofficial word coming here and there as well, it's going to be, you know, similar to assemblies that were held earlier where you got lay people and priests and deacons and bishops and everybody together in a big room. For me, this looks like they're building up to what they would call Vatican III, only they'll call it the real Vatican II, only realize now where lay people are sitting there with bishops making decisions. And this is horrific because it contradicts the hierarchical nature of the church. Now, Pope Leo can define and orient synodality in a proper and orthodox sense if we return to the source, which is Vatican II. Because, you know, it's quite clear the Synod of Bishops is a synod of bishops. And bishops were not chosen by the people. Bishops are successors of the apostles, and they receive their office, and they're ordained, and then they're sent out to govern the flock. Not the other way around.
Yeah, Father, it's also quite clear that, I mean, if we want to have a definitive ruling, and Bob mentioned this a moment ago, if you want a definitive ruling on female diaconate or a married priesthood, you got popes who've been signing off and opining on this for centuries, including the last two guys who said, case closed, church has already decided this, it can't happen. Why not just quote them and move on? This whole idea that we're studying and we're opening and you come in, it leaves the door open and it sends out the signal that somehow doctrine and practice is up for grabs if we just wait long enough. And that I find as a Catholic troubling. Bob, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that, Pope Francis is regarded by many people as a progressive. There are elements in his papacy that, are clearly in that direction, and there are others, that are more traditional. And a lot of the people who expected a great deal from him were saying openly that they were disappointed when he died. And so what we have, I think you're exactly right, Remy, and it goes to the point that this document that just came out this week says we have to take all points of view into, account, including the people who dispute the very idea of synodality. Now, that's really something to say, that we haven't really seen that element taking place in officially within the, process that they now have, which is a very, very managerial kind of approach to things. But I'll tell you, my blood ran cold when I read one sentence. It's worth actually looking for this. They say that we have to look at the resistances and the obstacles, including our own resistance to this process. So it's a kind of a almost, I don't know, ideological training of people that we're supposed to look at ourselves and say, because we have resistances, there's something wrong with us? No, maybe that there's something that has to be asserted about the way that the church is functioning. And I hope that Leo, he's trying to, I think, introduce a different tone or a different spirit about this synodality. But the very root of this is very, very troubling. And I hope they look very carefully at that as they're as the process goes forward.
Yeah, we'll obviously keep watching this, but it is troubling when you focus on exactly what's happening. You know, beyond the words, beyond the committees, and beyond all the kind of surface talk, it's deeply, it's a replacement of papal authority. That's really what it is. It's an expansion and a hijacking of papal authority. Father, a couple of curious developments by bishops this week. One, in the Czech Republic. The other in the Diocese of San Bernardino, California. The bishop in each diocese has ruled to suspend Sunday obligations to attend Mass. In the case of the Czech bishop, he's lifting the obligation because of the shortage of priests and the burden it can place on Catholics who have long commutes to a parish to get to Mass. In the case of San Bernardino, Bishop Alberto Rojas has made the decision to dispense the Sunday obligation due to the fear many in his flock have of ICE raids. Bishop Rojas has been a frequent critic of the administration's immigration enforcement methods. And Father, I guess, are these legitimate reasons to suspend obligation or the obligation to attend Sunday Mass? And or is this political grandstanding in a way?
In the case of the Czech Republic, there's no need for this because you're only obligated to go to Mass if there's a Mass available for you to go to. There's no obligation. The obligation falls if you can't get to it, and that's up to people to judge. For some people, you know, older folk, you know, having to walk a mile to church, it's impossible, and they just can't do it. No one expects them to go. They're not under that obligation. On the other hand, young people, you know, why not walk the mile instead of, you know, the 30 or 40 yards if you live next door to the church? So that's superfluous, I think. As regards San Bernardino, that it's a curious thing that the bishop has done because law enforcement is not wrong per se. It's not wrong to enforce just laws. So if people are afraid that they're going to be deported because they're illegally in the country and they're the target of an enforcement action, you know, why is that entering into the question of whether they should go to Mass or not on Sunday? People are conscious that they, you know, are subject to law enforcement. The better thing to do is voluntarily surrender and then have an orderly process for their deportation. And that's, you know, people who enter the country illegally, they know when they come in that there's a risk of them getting deported. So it's not like this is an unjust surprise that, you know, being imposed on them.
Yeah, Bob, I mean, it begs the question, will suspected mob leaders and celebrities get Mass dispensations, too? I mean, they might be harassed or arrested at Mass as well. Where does this end?
It's an interesting way of putting it, Raymond. Yes, I mean, it's clear that this is a kind of almost a virtue signaling, except I can't imagine what the virtue is here other than a kind of a political stance that this particular bishop wants to take. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for criticizing what our government does, but to take a group of people and tell them that they don't have to respect the idea of keeping holy the Lord's day because they came illegally and broke the law here in the United States. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's something off here. And then where do we draw the line? What other people, you know, what other Catholics who, you know, are in violation of the law that showing up at Mass might make them a target? I mean, come on. And speaking of politics, the USCCB has spoken out against President Trump's big, beautiful spending bill, despite the fact that it contains a very significant piece of pro-life legislation, the defunding of abortion giant Planned Parenthood. For 1 year, all Medicaid funds are barred from Planned Parenthood. Now, that's in addition to any funds going to them for abortion services. Despite the provision, the USCCB president, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, issued this statement. My brother bishops and I have repeatedly and consistently urged lawmakers to use the budget reconciliation process to help families in need and to change course on aspects of the bill that fail the poor and vulnerable. The bill as passed will cause the greatest harm to those who are especially vulnerable in our society. A father, then Bob, who's more vulnerable than the unborn?
The unborn threatened with death and with the government paying for it, yeah, they're the ones who are need to be protected. Unfortunately, this confirms a trend that we've seen, you know, throughout my lifetime, which is that the bishops endorse in these broad terms the Democratic Party agenda, which essentially is geared toward a welfare state mentality. And when he talks about taking care of the poor and vulnerable. Well, the bill's goal is to increase economic output and thereby to make economic opportunity available for more people. Whether it achieves or not is a secondary matter. But the bill is not designed to hurt poor people. It's designed to promote economic liberty in this country. That's certainly a value we should think about. But yes, if you're stopping the funding of Planned Parenthood, which has been a nightmare, you know, evil policy of our government for decades, we ought to stand up and rejoice and give thanks to the president.
Yeah. Bob, a judge, by the way, just placed a restraining order on that clause to show you that it does have teeth in it after Planned Parenthood sued the government because they want their Medicaid dollars. I'll give you the final thought on this.
Yeah. You know, our bishops even cite statistics and, you know, well, we always know that numbers are not everything when it comes to these moral questions. But if you talk about endangering people, and people will die because of cuts, so-called cuts in this big, beautiful bill. And by the way, as we know here in Washington, cuts never mean cuts. And in fact, in this particular case, what it means is that the growth of the spending is going to be slightly less than it would have been otherwise. Now, Father rightly raises this question. You know, there are larger moral questions in here, too. I mean, if the financial system, if the economy of the United States tanks because of these tremendous deficits that we're running, then we'll really see some destruction of the poor, because all of our safety net programs and whatnot are going to be in peril as a result of that. And look, the simple matter is the question of abortion is this. 1 million children, more or less, given the year, are killed every year in the womb because of abortion. There is nothing else like that happens in the United States that is the result of what the government allows to happen or makes happen. Globally, abortion is the number one cause of death in the world. There's 65 million abortions every year in the world. So if our bishops really wanted to be serious about what the most pressing threat to human life is, it's abortion. There's no debate about this. The numbers confirm it, and everybody knows it.
Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, we will leave it there. For more commentary from Robert and Father Gerald, visit thecatholicthing.org. And don't miss the Prayerful Posse dropping Friday on the Arroyo Grande Show YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to get into the new Mass Pope Leo celebrated this week, and some news on those blessings of gay couples by the church. Don't miss that. This week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, there is a new Superman movie in theaters, but the director, James Gunn, has kicked off the release, saying it's about immigrants and politics. Well, those comments ground the Man of Steel at the box office. I talked to film critic Christian Toto about what it all means. Why the abandonment of the core of this character? The American way. What's so dirty about that?
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, I don't think that saying it is going to chase anyone away. But going out of your way not to say it definitely leaves a bad taste in your mouth. I think it just does. And can't we have an American hero? It's okay. You know, if you live in Italy, if you live in Spain, other countries, you can appreciate an American hero who fights for justice. That's why is that repulsive? It's not. They could say, okay, this is an American character who happens to be very entertaining, who I've followed for years. And that's okay. If there was a Spain-based hero who was very loyalistic to his country and we loved him for years, and I wouldn't be upset about that. I'd go see that movie.
The entire Arroyo Grande Show is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to check it out. Subscribe so you don't miss a show. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all the links. Christians in Nigeria were hit with brutal jihadi attacks this summer in Nigeria's middle belt state of Benue. There was a large Christian population. An estimated 200 displaced Christians were murdered as they slept. As horrible as the details of this are, the violence against Christians in the region seems to be on the rise. Here to discuss all of this and more, director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea, and president of Solidarity with the Persecuted Church, Steve Wagner. Thank you both for being here. Nina, those 200 Nigerian Christians were murdered in Benue State. The perpetrators first targeted St. Joseph's Church in Yelawata. Tell us what we know about that June attack. What drove it?
Well, we know that they invaded. These are Fulani herders. They attacked a town, an agricultural town in Benue State, as you said. They came at midnight. They attacked for 3 hours. We know that there was a military forward operating base, if you will, there. And those soldiers did not leave their base. They shot into the dark. They didn't know what they were shooting at because they didn't have the proper equipment. They were ill-prepared and ill-trained. As a result, 200 people were actually killed there. They were sleeping in the marketplace. These were displaced Christians. They had already been displaced by prior attacks from other, or maybe the same Fulanis. The Fulani herders came on motorcycles carrying AK-47s. That means that someone is supplying them with these guns. Guns are illegal in Nigeria, but they're allowed to have them. They claim to be herders that are using traditional grazing routes through Nigeria to feed their herds. But these are not, they're snatching land. They're grabbing the land. They're driving the Christians off the land. That's what they want to do. The government seems to be complicit in this, in the sense that they don't protect them, the Christians. This is an attack of Muslims, apparently Islamicized or radicalized Muslims, who are shouting the holy war cry of Allahu Akbar as they kill. And that's how they know that who they are. Actually, that's how the survivors are able to identify them, and. The Christians are driven off the land. This is happening village after village after village, and they never can go back home. Once they're driven off, the land is not theirs anymore because the government doesn't return them.
Stephen, you're the president of Solidarity with the Persecuted Church. You were recently in Nigeria. Tell us about what you saw there, but also give us some insight into this, the complicity here between the government and these so-called herdsmen. They're actually jihadis.
Well, Raymond, thank you for your attention to the greatest humanitarian crisis that nobody's talking about. The situation is really dire. And Nigeria is a fascinating country. It's already the biggest in Africa by terms of population. It's number 6 in the world, and it's projected to overtake the United States to be the third largest country in the world. So it's a prime target for, as you said, the Islamic jihadists. And that is what's going on. There's an Islamic jihad targeting Christians for the purpose of turning Nigeria into a thoroughly Muslim state. Having visited there, having seen the place, I was there before this massacre that Nina talked about, but I was in the same location, and I can tell you that the government is complicit. The thing that's probably hardest for Americans to understand is, for Christians, there is no rule of law in Nigeria. When these teenagers on motorcycles show up at night with their AK-47s, as Nina described, drive people from their homes, the individuals can't pick up the phone and call the police. If they tried this, the police would say there's nothing we can do. There is no official response to defend Christians in Nigeria at this moment. And we have, therefore, a situation of 3 million Christians in internally displaced persons' camps. Now, there's a game of moral equivalence going on. They're saying, well, you know, both sides are at fault, blah, blah, blah. Raymond, I asked when I was there, I was taken to an IDP camp. IDP camp is merely somebody who hasn't crossed a refugee who hasn't crossed an international border yet. And I was shown these camps, which, as I say, in total contain 3 million people. And when I finished the tour, I said, okay, now show me the Muslim IDP camp. And it's kind of a bad joke because there isn't one. There are no Muslims living in IDP camps to speak of. It's an entirely Christian phenomenon. And the government of Nigeria needs to step up to the plate and protect its citizens.
Yeah, well, I want to play a testimonial from a Nigerian priest and get your reaction. Watch this.
Their ultimate goal is to kidnap the Christian. They will kill me if they kidnap me again. What I have is to serve the Lord. Because of this incident, before I didn't value what I have, I'm hearing a voice. If you deny me in the presence of this, I'll deny you in the presence of my Father.
Yes.
This keep me from the beginning to the end, and I survived the temptation. So I am very grateful, and I don't afraid of death. As you see me, I don't afraid of, I'm even ready to die. If it is because of Jesus, I'm dying here.
Stephen and Nina, tell us about this man, the faith of this priest, and the faith of the Nigerian people.
This was a priest up in Kaduna who had been kidnapped, and we recorded the testimony of a number of them, and each one said, I was convinced I was going to die, and I put my faith in the Holy Spirit, and I was saved. That's the inspirational side of this story. We have more martyrs, more Christian martyrs in Nigeria killed each year than in any other country on earth. But the faith is amazing. It's astounding to see.
Yeah, and death for religious reasons for these Christians is all around them. It's been going on, Raymond, for decades. And it's accelerating now. It's happening in various states in the country. Now, up in the Northeast, you have the terrorist group, the U.S.-designated terrorist groups of ISIS and Boko Haram. And there are Muslims in those IDP camps up there. But the biggest killer of the Christians now are these Fulani herders, these militias. And as Steve said, the government does not do anything to protect them, to defend them, to prosecute these Fulani murderers.
Well, Nina, in your June 30th article for the Hudson Institute, you write, the U.S. government does not acknowledge the Fulani's persecution of millions of Middle Belt Christians. The Biden administration removed Nigeria from the State Department's list of countries of particular concern, the most egregious violators of religious freedom. Where is the Trump administration on this? I know he met this week, the president did, with five presidents of various African countries. He's attempting to bring peace, I know, to Congo and Rwanda. What about Nigeria?
I don't understand why Nigeria is not on the agenda, because they are the most populous country in Africa. And they're one of the largest, if not the largest, economy. It's a very influential, important country, and it's falling really prey to Islamic extremism. We may have a terror state that is enormous. It's going to be an enormous security problem for all of us. And that is what's happening, but it's not acknowledged. The State Department continues the Biden line that this is a result of climate change. If it weren't so utterly tragic and horrifying, it'd be funny. It'd be laughable. This is climate change is causing this. Mm. They don't look into the motives of these Fulani or who's funding them, how they're organized, or the impunity that the government is giving them, letting them do what they want with the Christians and taking their land and cleansing them.
Yeah, Steve, what should the U.S. government be doing to help to end this violence in Nigeria? I mean, certainly the country of particular concern designation needs to be restored for Nigeria.
Well, Raymond, as you've seen in a number of cases, the president has a tremendous bully pulpit, as he showed with the president of South Africa, where he very strongly in an Oval Office meeting expressed his mm-hmm. dissatisfaction with the humanitarian crisis there. The president ultimately is the one who needs to engage on this issue. I think that American Christians will deeply appreciate him intervening on behalf of our Christian brothers and sisters in Nigeria who are the victims of a systematic persecution that is, as Nina said, being funded and armed by outside elements. So that's the project that we're involved in now. We're trying to get the administration to pay attention to this crisis. And, you know, there I believe it's a country hurtling towards civil war, because the Christians in Nigeria are not going to tolerate this for an indefinite period of time. The level of violence that's being perpetrated against them is such that they will react. This is human nature. And so we have an opportunity to intervene and prevent what could be a very, very dire human rights crisis.
And Steve, your organization has a petition to try to get the Trump administration to at least designate this as a country of particular concern and protect these Christians.
That's right, Raymond. Thank you. Solidarity with the Persecuted Church has a petition, the purpose of which is for the American people to express their opinion to the Trump administration, saying we would like you to do everything you can to alter the behavior of the government of Nigeria.
And Raymond,
Nina, go ahead.
Can I just add also that, Raymond, if your viewers could contact their member of Congress and have them sign on to co-sponsor House Resolution 220, Congressman Chris Smith, whom we know is a good Catholic and is concerned about this. He's head of the Subcommittee on Africa in Congress. He has a resolution that says, recommends to the State Department to name it a country of particular concern. And that is very important to put pressure.
Yeah, I want to move on for a moment, Nina, and talk about Sudan. Last month, three churches were bombed in El Fashar, the capital of Sudan's North Darfur state. Two separate attacks by the Rapid Support Forces. And they targeted churches, including the Sudanese Episcopal Church, the African Inland Church, and the Roman Catholic Church. At least five people were killed in the bombings on June 9th and 11th. Dozens more were injured. Among those casualties was a priest, a Father Luca Jomo, the parish priest of the Catholic Church in question. Where is the government on this? I mean, the U.S. government officially designated this rapid forces group as perpetrators of genocide. Is anything else being done to help these Sudanese Christians?
I don't know what is being done, Raymond. You know, it's been about 14 years now since South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan, was created for this very reason, because there was a genocide going on that was not acknowledged at the time against Christians in South Sudan and in North Sudan against South Sudan. Now it's its own country. The North is a very difficult place for Christians to live in. It's mostly Muslim, and many of them are radicalized. And their own government has basically fallen apart and doesn't have any rule of law or control. And our government is focused on trade, and it's focused on defense. But we really need this third pillar of our foreign policy, which is religious freedom.
Yeah, Steve, these human and religious rights need to be tied to any trade deals. And I think for whatever reason, it's not on the radar here, or it's escaping the radar. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, not yet. But what we've seen is the U.S. has tremendous influence through trade. Nigeria is a country that exports a lot of oil. It's extracted by American companies. There's tremendous opportunity for the Trump administration to lay down a marker defining itself as the defender of Christians around the world.
Mm-hmm. Nina, Steve, we will leave it there. I thank you for your insights. You can find Nina Shea's reporting on the persecution of Christians worldwide at Hudson.org. And follow Steve Wagner's work on behalf of persecuted Christians. He's at SolidarityPersecutedChurch.org. Thank you both. He's the director of one of the most prestigious choirs for boys in London, the London Oratory Schola Cantorum Boys Choir. It was founded in 1996. Their voices have graced the soundtracks of Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Harry Potter series. They've just released a brand new CD, a unique collection of sacred music titled Sacred Treasures of Rome. Here to tell us all about the new project and their upcoming U.S. tour that begins next week, Charles Cole. Charles, thanks for being here. 2025 is the 500th anniversary of Palestrina's birth, the greatest polyphonic composer of the Renaissance. Tell us who Palestrina was and why you chose his work as the main focus of this Sacred Treasures of Rome CD.
Palestrina's really the man who synthesized the most sublime, fully perfect polyphonic style of the Renaissance. He sort of brought it all together, and he's the name that's most synonymous with the best music of that period. And of course, as you say, he's got this really important milestone this year, 500th anniversary. And it seemed the obvious thing. We wanted to do a new recording, and we decided that we would definitely have some Palestrina on the recording, but we've also included other composers who were working alongside him and in his orbit, and probably in greater awe of him as well, in Rome mm-hmm. at the same time.
The Palestrina Festival in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I know you all will be singing there. You're touring all over the U.S. And then on July 16th, you'll be singing a pontifical mass at Sacred Heart Church, celebrated by Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone. Tell us a little about the upcoming tour in this special mass and how you sort of laid out this tour.
Well, the invitation to sing came from that festival in Grand Rapids. It's an absolutely incredible achievement of that parish. They've put together a really spectacular year-long festival, which involves a choral meditation and then a mass each month. And we are doing the July one, as you say, with Archbishop Cordileone, which is a great honor, and it's nice for us to renew our relationship with him. We've sung with him before, and we've also welcomed him at the London Oratory as well.
Charles, tell us about some of the other works on this album, contemporaries of Palestrina, and why those were chosen as part of the CD.
Well, I decided to do some research. So I went to Rome last year, and I was digging around trying to find things that I might not otherwise have come across. And what I discovered was quite interesting. There were a number of composers who had great links to St. Philip Neri at the Rome Oratory, which, of course, was highly significant, really, for us as a choir. And very, very nice to see this. Palestrina knew St. Philip Neri very well. He actually died in his arms at the end of his life, which is an extraordinary thing. And there's a particular composer, Giovanni Animuccia, who was a priest at the, it wasn't quite founded as the oratory yet, but in the early days of the oratory, Giovanni Animuccia was a priest working with St. Philip. And he was a very, very accomplished composer. But much of his music went missing. And it turned out that the parchment on which it was written was of such value that it was actually sold to a cheesemonger in Rome to wrap cheese. It just seems like a terrible crime. That music all went missing. But there are pieces scattered around in different libraries, and I found a very beautiful piece, which I was able to reconstruct, O Crux Ave Spezunica, which is very, very beautiful. But there are some other amazing composers on the album too. Probably another really interesting story is the Anerio brothers, Felice and Giovanni. They were very closely linked with St. Philip and the Oratory, and their mother actually used to do laundry for St. Philip. So there's a very close-knit connection there. And all of these people are absolutely standout composers, really incredible.
I want to give viewers a little taste of what they'll hear on Sacred Treasures of Rome. Take a look. Charles, before we run out of time, talk to me for a moment about sacred music and how important it is to preserve it, not only in the liturgy, but in the wider culture, particularly at a time when traditional forms of the liturgy are under attack, being suppressed, even within the church.
It's such an important thing, this beautiful music. And as you say, it has a very flourishing life outside the church. There are so many commercial groups who go around the world singing concerts and making recordings, and that's absolutely wonderful. And they kind of keep the standards elevated, as something that we should all aspire to. Liturgically, as you say, it's much harder to achieve. You need to be very, very committed to want a liturgical program that is going to involve music of this kind of level. But there's lots of encouragement, and Pope Leo himself recently gave a really beautiful address, which I'm sure you'll be aware of, where he was actually launching a set of Vatican stamps honouring Palestrina, and he spoke very movingly about the way the different parts move inside the polyphonic world of Palestrina, and they kind of give way to each other. They come together to create very beautiful moments, and then they move back into their place again. And he was using that as a sort of analogy for what we should do as Christians. So I think that's great encouragement indeed.
Well, we will leave it there. Sacred Treasures of Rome by the London Oratory Schola Cantorum Boys Choir is available now at music outlets everywhere and online, including Amazon and Apple Music. For more information on their U.S. tour beginning on July 16th in Grand Rapids, Michigan, visit LondonOratoryScola.com. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to check us out next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.